Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else? The Iditarod. We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we dive in, here's a word from our sponsor.
Support for Iditapod 2018 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
And welcome to the Daylight Savings Time edition of the Iditapod. This 1 hour spring forward on our clock still happens in Alaska, and it happens every year during Iditarod. The race starts the first Saturday in March. Daylight Savings Time happens very early the second Sunday in March. And say you're an exhausted race official or volunteer or trail reporter trying to make predictions on specific times of day that the mushers might arrive at a particular checkpoint, things can get tricky. For most of us, it just means we lose another hour of sleep. And what's another hour of sleep lost among friends, really? But for the mushers and dogs out on the trail, the concept of time kept on circular clocks anyway, it kind of loses its meaning. They're keeping track of run and rest times, for sure, and racing the race clock that started ticking a week ago now. But the sun comes up, the sun goes down, and still the race goes on. Because time is relative, we're going to go back to an interview with our trail reporter, Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes. It's from Unalakleet, where he arrived yesterday. And we're going to talk about another abstract concept, that is fantasy mushing, coming up. First, though, let's have a quick race update, shall we? I'm recording here Sunday morning. Since time has no meaning, I don't know when you're actually listening to this, but Girdwood's Nicholas Petit has regained the lead after his two main competitors right now, that's defending champ Mitch Seavey and Norwegian Yor Leif Seth Olsom, caught up with Petit in Anvik. That's where he was taking his 8-hour layover. Seavey and Olsom had to take their 8-hour layovers just a little ways down the trail in Grayling, though, and Petit stopped there only a little over half an hour. He continued on up the Yukon River, and looking at the Iditarod's GPS tracker, it looked like a slog there at times, maybe breaking trail or going way out on a limb here, but maybe even dealing with overflow. Anyway, Petit arrived first in Caltag about 7:45 last night, and for that, he wins 25 pounds of Bristol Bay salmon and $2,000 from Bristol Bay Native Corporation, as well as a piece of art by Apayu Moore. The Iditarod says they'll present the artwork and the award at the finisher's banquet in Nome. I'm not sure about the salmon, though. Nick might have to coordinate with a buddy who has a big freezer on that one. I'm pretty sure he's not going to carry 25 pounds of salmon with him the rest of the way on the race. After resting in Caltag for about 6 hours, Petit gathered up what other supplies he might have wanted and headed west on the trail toward Unalakleet on the Bering Sea coast a little before 2 this afternoon. But Seavey and Olsom are not far behind. They each rested only a little more than 4 hours before heading out of Caltag, and the last time I checked, Olsom was only about 5 miles behind, with Seavey back another 5 miles or so. Those three are really racing each other for now, and we're seeing other teams heading out of Caltag. Still bunched up close together are Pete Kaiser, Richie Deal, and Ray Reddington Jr. A little ways behind them, Wade Mars, Travis Beals, Matt Failer, and Two Rivers musher Matt Hall, the pride of Eagle, is now the top rookie in the Iditarod in 10th place out of Caltag. They're all headed to Unalakleet, and it's this run up and along the coast to Shaktulik, Koyuk, Elim, White Mountain, Safety, and then finally on to Nome that can really make or break a team's race. Now, just to point out, they have another 8-hour rest in White Mountain, so based on who gets there in first place and what time they arrive, you might have a good idea of who's going to win the race. And that's generally the case, but things can still happen in that last 77 miles or so between White Mountain and Nome. I'd guess we'd see the top teams passing under the Burled Arch, the finish line in Nome, sometime Tuesday, but you never know. Storms have a tendency to pop up when you least expect them out there. That's all a long way of saying there's still a lot of Iditarod left, and with Zach into Unalakleet yesterday, Unk we like to call it, we thought it'd be helpful to talk about how things in the race have shaped up so far, where we've been, where we're going. So we had a nice long chat about all that yesterday, and you might hear references to days and yesterdays like you have already, but time has no meaning, everybody, so try not to overthink it. Anyway, here's my conversation with Zach. Hey, Zach, how's it going?
Hello, Casey Grove. It's going great right now. How are you?
I'm doing well. So where are you right now anyway?
Right now, I'm in Unalakleet, one of my favorite places. I'm posted up here, waiting for when racers start to arrive, which might not be for a while. And frankly, after how hectic a night it was yesterday in Anvik, that's kind of fine by me.
How's the beard holding up?
Beard's fine. Needs a trim.
Has it been keeping your face warm?
It hasn't been that cold, Casey. Oh. It's been pretty easy.
Huh.
Yeah, it's been a very mild weather year, trail-wise, for the most part. The wind on the Yukon was really bad the last night or two, and mushers were going into headwinds and just gusts. And in town in Anvik, it was blowing, but it wasn't blowing too bad. But Aaron Burmeister pulled in at one point, and just his dogs, you know, had these kind of ice beards from running into the wind for several hours. And he just said the wind was just whipping off the Yukon. So,
yeah, so they're on the Yukon. A big bunch of mushers are on the Yukon right now. But I wanted to ask you to kind of hit the rewind button and take us back a little bit, because I figured this would be a good time to kind of check in about the race as it's been run so far. So give me a quick recap of how we got here.
I think the biggest way that we got here is, so there's essentially kind of two races happening right now. There's a three-way race for the top spot, and that's between Yor Olsson, Mitch Seavey, and Nick Petit in no particular order. Nick Petit might have a slight edge, but we can get into that later. But those guys are all running really close, and the next few hours and next day or so is going to be really telling. Behind them is a extremely dense chase pack of really good mushers, many of whom are leapfrogging each other and jockeying for position. And, you know, every spot in the top 20 is a difference of a couple $1,000s. So a minute here or there at a checkpoint that could cost you, you know, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, 100 miles away in Nome, those are the kinds of considerations people are eyeing as they race. And so on that top knot, that three-way race, a lot of how we got here happened heading into Iditarod. Yor Olsson took that really kind of bold move and pushed all the way up there for his 24. And when he was doing it, he hit weather. So he did that run in, I believe it was 14 or 15 hours to get there, resting along the trail, of course. And he was banking on that weather sticking around and it hampering the other guys who were chasing him, who had taken their 24-hour breaks earlier. So Mitch, Nick, Petit, but sort of backfired because the weather abated and those guys had much faster runs, 12 and 13 hours, I believe, across the same stretch. And so they made up time that Olsson had gotten by pushing that way. And that really sort of set things up for a much tighter race in the several hundred miles since then.
So that's the three that are running up front and have been here for a little ways. And you mentioned this already, but tell me a little bit more about that chase pack. It's pretty dense, you said?
It's very dense. And last night in Anvik, it all hit like a freight train. First, you had Pete Kaiser going through, and then Richie Deal, and then Ray Reddington Jr., and then Jesse Royer and Wade Mars and Linwood Fiedler and all these guys just blowing through, and mushers just coming through every 5 minutes. And Casey, I have to tell you, I've been to quite a few race checkpoints and people were just so focused. I mean, to the point where it almost looked like crazed, myopic, just exhaustion, just people getting into Anvik, trying to get out as quickly as they can. The problem was that Eagle Island, this critical checkpoint further up the Yukon, was closed down because of weather, and that altered everybody's strategy and kind of threw this major wrench into things. And I think you're going to see that the Yukon is where this race was made for a lot of people. So that chase pack, almost everyone, once news came down that Eagle Island was going to be closed, everybody started to recalibrate, I think, where they were going to take their 8-hour rests. That's not to say some people wouldn't have taken it in Shagaluk, but as a result, we saw this huge bottleneck in Shagaluk. Where at one point there were just more than a dozen teams just all piled up waiting to be released from their eights. And that knot has just been cycling through a lot of the checkpoints. You know, what happened with Eagle Island was it's a very austere checkpoint. It's a lot like Ophir or Iditarod. There's a shelter cabin there and not much else. And weather kept out the supplies that the Iditarod needs to bring in. So drop bags that mushers had sent along filled with food for their dogs, food for themselves, supplies, stuff like that. But also things like hay, straw, that, you know, they need to rest their dogs and keep them warm when they're giving them a rest on this massive stretch of the trail. I mean, the distance from Grayling all the way up to Kaltag is like 130 miles. So Eagle Island, even if it's austere, if that's a place where you can get straw and food, it's a good place to take a rest. But that's not what was available. So mushers were basically facing 130 miles with almost no support. So that means hauling more supplies from Grayling. They were only allowed to take one bale of straw, which is heavy, but it also means, you know, that's all you get to rest your team up along the way. A lot of mushers who were blowing into Anvik were very bothered by that news. They didn't like it. So, you know, throughout yesterday afternoon and on overnight, people were contending with one of the most challenging stretches of the race in extra challenging circumstances. And on top of that, the wind was blowing at them. So nothing was going well for people on Friday night on the Yukon. And some of what's happening with the chase pack is you're starting to see mushers who have really fast teams are starting to leapfrog. Strategy does a lot for people. Consistency and animal care does a lot for people. But particularly on these long, flat runs on the Yukon, if you've got a fast dog team that's pulling faster than other people with everybody bunched up, you're going to go by people. So we've seen Travis Beals spring forward a few places. I know Matt Fahler's team is running pretty fast. And, you know, those guys that are a little further back, they're not breaking trail quite the same way that the people in front of them are.
So you had talked about the three that are running up front, and then there's this chase pack there. But really anything can still happen at this point. Nobody up front has this locked up, right?
Nobody has this locked up. That said, the three that are in the front are really racing against each other at this point. Everyone else is hoping to maybe get there, but is mostly racing against the rest of the race pack. So Aaron Burmeister, Richie Deal, Pete Kaiser, Wade Mars, Linwood Fiedler, Jesse Royer, a lot of the people in that sort of top knot there, they're really jockeying for who could be fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh. It would be really hard for them to overtake the lead that Mitch, Yor, and Nick have right now. And opinions divided over who in that top three has the best advantage right now. I think that Nick, by doing a really long run into Anvik to get there and then giving his dogs an eight-hour rest, maybe that saved him time and really kind of gave him a slight advantage. He declared his eight before finding out that Eagle Island was going to be closed down. So to the extent that Nick had a plan, he was able to execute it before this kind of wrench was thrown into things. That said, it also means that he was going to have to haul a bunch of material in his sled, hay and food, from Grayling when he wasn't expecting to do that. By contrast, Mitch and Yor were had to, I think, adjust on the fly over where they were going to take their eights. And I don't know if they've chipped into Nick's lead. I don't know if Nick has sort of a competitive edge over there. As we're speaking right now, he's got a couple of miles over them. But I tell you, with runs and rests and several hundred miles left and weather up and down the coast, I really don't know what could happen. Nick in particular is a very variable musher. I mean, he was in a really good position a few years ago and reached Unalakleet, and his team just quit on him because he pushed him too hard. So it's hard to say.
Definitely, and hard to say on the coast what the weather's going to do. But probably, you're right, probably somewhere between those front three for who comes in first place.
You know, generally, we know who's going to win by who reaches White Mountain at what time. Other people will say, you know, the race is really won by the time they get to Kaltag, and that crossing the portage and over to the coast is a pretty good determination of who's going to be where in what order. I don't know that with a chase pack this dense and separated by so little time that I really feel confident that Kaltag is going to determine how people are along the coast. There's just so much space and such variable weather that it really feels like a lot of stuff can shift, and that's also true for the front of the pack, especially with the way that people are pushing their dogs, shorting them on rest a little bit. We've seen, you know, Yor is known to sometimes keep his dogs at 3 hours when he's trying to make up time instead of 4 hours. He's definitely been doing that, but his speeds have been a little bit more consistent than Petit's. Mitch's speeds have been really consistent, but who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, even weather aside, you mentioned this too, that this has happened to Nick Petit when he was running pretty well, that the dogs can just quit on you. And if you don't give them enough rest, they're not going to want to keep going. You could be way up front in the pack and still just completely drop out of the race. So still, I mean, we keep saying this, but like anything can happen. Zach, how are you doing on rest?
I'm okay. As I think we've said before, it's a lot harder for the mushers. But yeah, some late nights and school gyms and cafeterias, and especially in the evenings and the afternoons, if we're out reporting and getting tape and talking with people, then by the time you get back to the school or wherever you're staying and eat and sit down and start to begin your real work, it can start to get quite late. And suddenly you find yourself at 1 a.m. underneath your jacket in a library talking to yourself in a microphone to try and track a package and mix it down as you're blinking through the bleariness in your contacts weekly eating trail mix. But for the most part, I'm pretty good.
Sounds great. One way to kind of figure out what the mushers are going through, obviously, is to ask them when they get into checkpoints. And sometimes the question is like, what sort of crazy things have happened out there? So I wanted to ask you that. What sort of crazy, like funny, goofy things have stood out to you here?
Well, it would be hard to not mention the bells of Anvik not ringing. I think you mentioned that earlier in a podcast. But basically, you know, Anvik hosts this very old historic Episcopal church. It's the oldest Episcopal church in Alaska, and a lot of history there. And traditionally, when the Iditarod has come through town, they'll ring the church bell when the first musher is about a quarter of a mile away, coming up the Anvik River over into town. And so at 4:30 in the morning the other night, when Nick Petit was coming in and people started tromping around the school gym, waking everyone up, getting ready, I kind of wanted to stay in my sleeping bag, but I did want the sound of those church bells because I thought that was such a cool thing, especially in a place where the race hadn't gone through in 5 years.
Right.
And we're waiting, and suddenly Nick's team appears very quietly under a headlamp around a corner. And it turns out that the mayor, Jason Jones, had tried to ring the bell, but the bell was frozen, and so no bell. And my big trip down the hill was just to hear Nick Petit say that it was cold, and then hear somebody describe a menu full of foods I was not going to get to eat. So that stands out. The other thing is Anvik is very musical, and we got kind of serenaded with these young men yesterday at the checkpoint who had guitars in the community center. Yeah. And were just playing along, and it was kind of a really pleasant scene down at the checkpoint. Very casual, but very, very nice, very quaint.
So a couple guys doing some Iditarod busking. We've got you on the mic freestyling. Thanks for talking.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
The intrepid reporter Zach Hughes there in Unalakleet. No doubt he is strategizing about what his next story is going to be for us. And we've talked about the strategy of where to take mandatory rest. And we have a question from a listener today about how they spend that time during their breaks, not just on their 24s and their 8s, but the breaks that they take out on the trail to snack dogs and bed them down for 2, 3, 4 hours sometimes.
Hey, this is Sam from Minneapolis. I've got a question about the breaks during the Iditarod. I understand that mushers have to take a 24-hour mandatory break, as well as a couple other shorter ones. Curious what they're doing besides sleeping, if anything. I mean, I'm sure they have to spend a lot of time sleeping and refueling, feeding dogs, things like that. But curious if they're up to a whole lot else during that time. Thanks.
Hey, Sam. This is a great question. Actually, mushers do not sleep that much on their rests, even though they're technically called that. On the longer ones, the 24 and the mandatory 8 along the Yukon and the mandatory 8 in White Mountain, sure, they'll catch a couple of hours and maybe even restore a little bit of what they've lost in the days in between. But out on the trail, a lot of the time, the mushers are resting their dogs for 3 or 4 hours in between checkpoints and just kind of camping alongside them. There, they might get a quick snooze in or something like that, but it's pretty spare. A lot of what they're doing is just really basic chores, putting straw down so their dogs can rest, getting them food, which involves heating up water a lot of the time to melt and defrost food, stuff like that. There's just a lot of chores. For some of the longer ones, they're also doing sled maintenance. So in Takotna and McGrath and Ophir and Iditarod, when everyone's posted up for a while, they might kind of chip away at problems that they've had with their sleds, change out runner plastic, which affects how quickly their sleds move over different types of snow, stuff like that. They'll eat and they'll just take care of a lot of their basic needs. So there's a lot that happens during rests, but sleep, I gotta say, is not always one of the big ones. Thanks.
As always, please send your questions to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. We love getting listener questions from race fans, dog mushing fans, fans of the Iditarod. The best way to do that is to send us a voice memo recording. You can do that on most smartphones. They have an app. You open that up, record your question, and send it on in to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. And that's your chance to get on the podcast. We like hearing your voice. We like hearing the enthusiasm. So please send those on in. And in Alaska, we're totally obsessed with the Iditarod and dog mushing, but what if you don't live here? What if you're just a fan somewhere that there isn't even some snow? Enter a new virtual sport for Iditarod superfans. It's called Fantasy Mushing. Our colleague at Sitka radio station KCAW, Catherine Rose, has this report.
In Paris, Texas, software developer David Hunt is riding his bike, except not really. He's running his sled dogs. Yes, sled dogs. In Texas. Improvised traces connect their harnesses to the handlebars of the bicycle, and they're running like the wind down a county road.
Well, I guess I've always been kind of drawn to the outdoors, so I just kind of like the idea, you know, of a race across the Alaskan wilderness. The last remaining open spaces, you might say, in the United States for the most part, and so I like the idea of an untamed wilderness and everything it holds.
Hunt's longstanding fascination with Alaska began in his fourth grade classroom when he learned about the Iditarod. He's been a dedicated follower of the race ever since. Hunt's never been to Alaska, but he's found a few ways to bring Alaska to him.
I just got the idea one day that I wanted to run dogs. I wanted to see what it was all about. So I made the decision to get a couple dogs and started working with them and training them. And I found out it is a lot harder than I thought.
He named his first two dogs Rainy and Ruby after Iditarod checkpoints. Blaze is his newest addition. He usually runs them on his bike. Sometimes he uses a land rig, a sled that runs on dry land that he's built from scratch with everything from scrap metal to chain link fence. Running dogs in Texas does come with a few challenges. Hunt has to wait for the temperature to drop.
We're not able to run year-round by any means, but we can run a few months out of the year, and mostly small runs and just for exercise, but it's fun to do. People, you know, stop asking me if I need help, you know, why are you out here with these dogs on a bike? But it's I do get some looks, but it's all good. That just goes with it.
A few months a year and only short runs, that's not much for someone with David's passion for mushing. But luckily, he has another way to get involved with a sport he's long appreciated from afar.
Okay, and Dad, can we get you to do a plug for Fantasy Iditarod?
Fantasy what? Is that something that's...
That's an incredulous three-time Iditarod champion, Mitch Seavey. His son, Danny Seavey, also an Iditarod veteran, thinks that many people interested in the Iditarod might be a little daunted by the information and stats involved with the sport.
I think very few people really understand competitively what's going on out there. It's sort of like the Tour de France, right? We know there's time trials and there's stages and they're sort of on teams, but not really. But nobody really knows what's going on over there, right? The Iditarod is kind of the same way. So I've long felt that if we could make it more accessible to people so they understood more of what was going on, that it would be more enjoyable to watch.
In the early 2000s, CV and his cousin began to work on a program, one he hoped would make the Iditarod more accessible to students and fans. Originally called Fantasy Iditarod, the program started out as a Google Doc and a spreadsheet that CV shared with fans through Facebook. When you sign up, you're allotted $27,000 imaginary dollars. You build a team of seven mushers, and you can even join a pack of friends you'll compete against. Danny's brother Conway updated the algorithm in 2014, but the fans really pushed them to make it grow. One of those fans was Hunt.
Some of our fans would really get into it. They were starting to publish some pretty advanced mathematical analyses of our stats. And it became a lot of fun. And through that, I met David. He was putting some advanced analytics in there. And he's one of these computer genius guys that can make a computer do anything.
They formed a long-distance friendship over their love for mushing. In 2015, CV had to run an Iditarod tour, so he asked Hunt to take over the fantasy page.
He not only took over, but he built a website and made it way better. And it's been really cool. So I hope he wants to keep doing it.
For now, Hunt is going to keep planning his own run goal, a trail spanning over 100 miles in northeast Texas, and then hopefully a trip to Alaska in the future. He owns a real dog sled and brings it into his wife's kindergarten class to teach students about the Iditarod and dog mushing. And he has a new litter of puppies, only a few weeks old.
I did pick out some awesome Alaskan names, but our four-year-old son, he decided to pick out his puppy, and he has named it Favorite. It is his favorite. So I think that name's going to stick, so I might have to find some other names for the others.
And Favorite is a perfect name. He's already one of the fastest sled dogs in Texas. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
So we've got a story about fantasy mushing from Sitka. It includes a guy from Paris, Texas, and we're talking about a race from Willow to Nome. We're all over the map here. And I don't want to impugn my journalistic integrity here at all, but last year I was not reporting on the race, and I was actually entered in that fantasy mushing team Squarebanks, and at one point was in fourth place. But that was the best I did, and I think I finished outside of the top 20. Anyway, that's all we have time for today. You can check back tomorrow for the next edition of the Iditapod. You can also find us on iTunes and other podcatcher apps. If you haven't already, please subscribe. You can also listen online at alaskapublic.org. The rest of our Iditarod coverage is there. Pictures, stories, more audio. Our theme music, speaking of audio, is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails. And a huge storm came up. Those are not
an indoor dog.
Those are not sled dogs, are they?
No, those are house dogs.
Appropriate though.